And I met Sharon Gannon, and one of her key phrases in her overall phraseology was, a miracle is a shift in perception. And that was a simple phrase, but it blew my mind because the shift in perception that she was talking about is something that was always there. It existed, but it was hidden. You couldn't see it. So the miracle is the metaposition to see what is hidden. And this intrigued me, really opened my mind.
This is the Jai Sugra Method. We train to master our own mind.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the podcast. On today's show, I will share a little bit about the four sutras, the first four sutras of Master Patanjali, and a little bit about the eight limbs of yoga. I want to take a stab at my current understanding of what yoga is about through the lens of what has been left historically by masters of the past, namely Patanjali. And there have been many interpretations of Master Patanjali's work. I am just one of a long, long line of yogis who have tried to apply these teachings over several decades to life. Before we get cracking on the sutras and the yamas and niyamas and the eight limbs, I'd like to remind you that this podcast is sponsored by Common CBD. Just use my ambassador link in the show notes to filter your CBD products through me. This will help support the show and support your health because the quality of product coming from Commons is very high level. And I trust four things that I use daily, which are the CBD stick for my nicks and scrapes, a tincture before I write. I use the night gummy before bed, and I use the day gummy in the morning with my tea or coffee. So this helps me with the anti-inflammatory effect for the brain and the periphery of the body that I'm going for. It also helps to stabilize my energy and my moods, particularly as I age, I get more aware of my cognition and how my brain is functioning. So I minimize things that can be toxic to the brain, like alcohol, things that can be toxic to the lungs, like smoking. And I use things that stabilize the body's energy, like in the morning, bulletproof tea or bulletproof coffee. And CBD is part of my arsenal for long-term brain health and overall health. So use Common CBD if you want to try CBD products. And again, the ambassador link in the show notes will support this show. You can also reach out to me from my website, jaisugram.com, for personalized coaching on your health, your wellness, your mindset. And you can support this show on Patreon at patreon.com/jaisugram. Becoming a patron of the show gives you unique member benefits like pop-up classes, first dibs on retreats, and just being more proximal to the challenges and teachings that I give. You join the inner circle, the inner council, so to speak. So without further ado, let's launch into the first four sutras. Now, before we get cracking, I want to share a little bit about my history of yoga because it's kind of cultural and personal. I want to share something about my childhood. My family is Indian, but we were not born in India. We're a generation or two removed from India because India was ruled by the British, and the British Empire used to be far and wide ranging at one point in history. They had many commonwealths all over the world. So you'll, for example, find Indians living in parts of Africa. You'll find Indians living in South America and the islands around South America and the Caribbean. So my family, way back in the day, came as indentured servants initially from India over to Guyana to work the fields as farmers. So they had plantations, and namely sugar plantations. in South America. So my family eventually became independent and were farmers, but they retained their culture and the traditions, with the exception of Hindi. They started speaking and educating themselves in an English-British system. And the priest class, the pundits and priests at the temples, they would speak Sanskrit and be able to chant the text properly and speak some Hindi. And I have cousins in my family who went as far as to study Hindi as children when they were growing up and entering high school and college. I went the way of playing sports and did not connect to the languages. I also felt when our family left Guyana, my parents came to America and the kids went to live with my mother's family in the countryside in Guyana in South America. So we were separated for a few years. And then we went to Canada for a couple of years, from age 0 to 6, I lived in South America. 6 to 8, I lived in Vancouver, Canada. And then 8 onwards, I lived in New York. 8 to about 12, New York City, and then 13 to 18 in upstate New York. So that's a lot of moving around. And what happens is, to a child's mind, looking back at this time and this movement of energy is, you know, children are looking to, in many ways, belong and map the territory. And the brain is looking for shortcuts. It's looking to become an efficient organ by memorizing things and automating many of the processes of life so that it can spare energy. It's a very expensive organ. So my brain, instead of being in one place and mapping the territory, my brain was always adapting. I had to try to fit into different cultures. And in a way, this made childhood very difficult by moving to so many places by age 13 and 3 different countries. It became challenging to feel like part of any one place. For example, when you made friends, you'd be moving on to a new place and you'd have to prove yourself again and fit in again. And it was always difficult, but the benefit of that is it gives you a mental flexibility. It gives you an ability to read people. So it had some very good adult benefits. And one thing I noticed is as I got more into the Western culture, I was living in two worlds. I wanted to fit in and connect to people at the schools I went to, but my culture at home was not popular then. When I was a child, yoga was still a fringe sort of practice in America and the West. Teachers like Ram Dass had been to India, and he was beginning to popularize the teachings of India, the teachings of his guru, Maharaj. And he wrote a book called Be Here Now, which was inspiring many people, but it was still not what it is today. So being Indian and hearing the Sanskrit pujas and worship at home were one thing, but I wanted to get away from that. All of my childhood, I felt very shy. I would say up till my mid-20s, because of a specific life event, I didn't embrace the culture of yoga, the language of Sanskrit. I hadn't even traveled to India myself till I was about 27 years old was my first trip. And I've done a whole handful of long journeys there. But I didn't really connect to the root of my culture and accept it until I started maturing more away from seeking validation and needing to be validated by the group. I really pushed the culture to the side. So the first 4 sutras of Master Patanjali will be explored today, but know that I have been hearing this stuff since childhood, ran away from it for a large part of my life, and then came back to it to quench my thirst for knowledge and to heal my mind from suffering. I had lost my youngest brother at age 27. At 27, my youngest brother, Anil Christopher Sugrum, died in a motorcycle accident. And so I went on a painful journey of partying, addiction, inebriation, even long distance running to sort of transcend my mind to deal with the pain. And none of that really, really worked at all. It was when I accidentally discovered Vinyasa Yoga and I was in Shavasana, I started to get a sense of peace. And what intrigued me about yoga was the direct experience, as opposed to a top-down spirituality. For example, in the energy of a priest, some people believe when they are around the priest or pastor that the knowledge that they have of the texts of the spiritual system of enlightenment can come down to them. And other people believe they have to be in the energy of the shaman in order to receive blessings and insight. And what I like about yoga is that it's very much about your personal experience and allowing a teaching to flower in your consciousness. And then when you walk through your life to see that teaching applied to how you respond to the experiences of life. So it's a truly transformational practice that I lean on, and I think I will continue to lean on for my whole life. I want to explore the concept with you now of a miracle being a shift in perception. So my teacher, Sharon Gannon, at the Jivamukti Yoga School, this was where I first took to the yoga practice in 2008. Around 2008, I started to take yoga on more seriously after I had a trip to India. And I met Sharon Gannon, and one of her key phrases in her overall phraseology was, a miracle is a shift in perception. And that was a simple phrase, but it blew my mind because the shift in perception that she was talking about is something that was always there. It existed, but it was hidden. You couldn't see it. So the miracle is the metaposition to see what is hidden. And this intrigued me, it really opened my mind. The first time I started to experience this in yoga classes was, again, 08, 09. Like, for example, I remember specifically this one forward bend in a class in the summer of 2009. And this practically inspired me to become a yoga teacher. Is I was in a forward bend, and it was a day when we had chanted the mantra, Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu. And this mantra means, may all beings everywhere be happy and free, and may my thoughts, words, and actions contribute to the happiness and freedom of others. And on this day, I chanted the mantra, I let it sit in. And when I was in the practice and I did a forward bend and I drew the navel back and massaged my organs, I personally, for out of the blue, I got a wave of emotions overtook me, and I started tearing up and crying. And I was a little, for a second, embarrassed, but then I realized I was in a yoga class and everyone else is probably paying attention to their own practice. So I allowed the tears to stream. And what I was feeling was universal compassion for all beings, including animal beings and all kinds of people that I don't even know or feel a connection to in a proximal sense, but people that are on the other side of the planet. I wanted everyone to be happy in that moment. And I wondered why, after class, this shift in perception happened. And I accepted it as a deep truth because the experience was so visceral. I realized that the joy I was seeking, the peace I was looking for from the suffering I was enduring from the death of my brother, that other people all over the planet probably have these same desires for peace, even if they don't know that peace exists within, that it's probably similar and there is knowledge that is hidden from us because we are only perceiving our repeating patterns of the mind. And so I wanted to uncover more miracles and experience more shifts in perception. So I began to take to the practice seriously. And this begs the question of looking into yoga philosophy. And at the Jivamukti Yoga School, they weave in philosophy with the physical, a very physical body-oriented practice. So I'll give you a structure of a class there at the legendary New York City Jivamukti School, which I was a part of for a decade. I actually started teaching there in 2009, and I lasted 11 years. 10 years I taught there in total. And I closed down the last class there with Yogeshwari for the final New Year's Eve celebration. So it was a big part of my personal chronology, and to take to the teachings that were given and to run with them and embrace them and to finally give back to the method and teach it properly in the mothership was a tremendous honor. And I thank my teacher, Sharon Gannon and David Life, for their work and for giving me the opportunity to teach and grow into the teacher that I am today by sharing their audience with me and opening the house of yoga that they made to me. So I was exposed. So a typical structure of a class is you start with, let's say, breath work, some breathing, and then you have a Sanskrit shloka or verse from a sacred text like the Yoga Sutras of Master Patanjali, or a text like the Bhagavad Gita, or the Puranas, a story from the Puranas. These are ancient Sanskrit texts that are loaded with wisdom, usually aphorisms, that once they're unpacked and translated and explained, our brains can filter those narratives through our own experience, and they can have a great impact on us later on when we're moving through the actions of our life and taking action. So one text that attracted me and has become a lifelong study, we can think of yoga and yogic studies as a bullseye. So, you know, we have an archery bullseye, and further on the periphery is a circle, and the circles get concentrically smaller and closer to the center until we hit the very median point, the very center here, which is where we want the arrow to go. And when we hit the center of a teaching, we experience it, and then we speak about it from our experience. But what was attractive to me about this text, it's 196 verses that Master Patanjali codified. We can say it could be 300 BC or 300 Common Era after Christ. Okay, so we're not sure exactly when he lived. There are 196 verses over four chapters. And Patanjali may have been several persons, like the sage Vyasa, who's attributed, they attribute several texts to him, or he could have been one person responding to the popularity of Buddhism, and he codified the yogic method, or the method of bringing the mind into concentration, and he called them the Yoga Sutras. And the sutras we can think of as verses, and it's split into, the book is split into four chapters, and the sutras are kind of cryptic. You need commentaries to understand them, or a teacher helping you, a lineage-based teacher helping you to unpack the commentaries. And traditionally, they were memorized through Sanskrit chanting first, then a teacher came along and taught their meaning. It was thought that by chanting them, some of the meaning could be sort of absorbed or intuited So students usually chanted them first, memorized them in order, and then they were interpreted and expounded upon. And then through more sadhana or conscious spiritual practice, one would then have these teachings really light up or flower in their mind. And then they would be your own. You'd then in turn, after many years of experience, be able to pass these teachings on after you have become a veteran and seasoned in experiencing the teachings. So Patanjali obviously had direct experience of the process of enlightenment. You can feel that when you read the text, that he knows what he's talking about. He has mastered the mind and he understands the stages of cleaning the mind. So the reason I'm focusing on his first four sutras today is because they give a definition of yoga. They encapsulate the yogic process if one can unpack these four sutras and look a little deeper into the codes of behavior. How does a yogi who understands this live? So what are the yogic actions? And for this, we need to look further into the eight limbs of yoga. So first I will unpack Patanjali's first four sutras, which have given me a sort of goal to shoot for. And it is a vast, now that I'm 47 years old, I'm speaking here on June 7th of 2022. I'm 47 years old and I've been practicing yoga for about 21 years, respectfully and diligently and consistently. You know, initially it was a 1 to 3 day a week practice, and then it became an everyday practice. And I had a phase of a decade with 5 hours a day of practice. And now it's just woven into my hard wiring. It's part of the framework of my mind. Many of these sutras are presuppositions in my consciousness, which affect the lens through which I view the world and I view my social interactions, my business interactions, and the way I want to conduct myself with my sense of personal ethics, so as to tread lightly and not incur so much negative karma in the world. So the first book of the sutras, the first chapter is called Samadhi Pada, and the chapter on pure awareness. Samadhi is pure awareness, or same as the highest. It's the highest possible state of perception. It's a non-dual state of perception where we perceive reality for what it is. So I want to chant these sutras to the best of my ability. So you get the idea of how the mouth moves. The jaw must move so that the syllables vibrate in five mouth positions. And then that puts me in vibration with the teaching, which I will then expound upon, again, to the best of my ability and with respect to the teachers that have come before me that have shared this knowledge with me. I will not get it right, but maybe I will open up some doors in your awareness, doors in your consciousness to further investigate the texts of perhaps true scholars like the yogi Edwin Bryant. Professor Edwin Bryant wrote a fantastic commentary that I have leaned on over the years. And I have about, you know, maybe 15 to 20 have different interpretations of the sutras. There's enough to fill a half of a library on the planet. Many, many people seeking wisdom have come across this text because literally it is like the user's manual for the brain. The Macintosh computer, my Honda HRV, new chainsaw, all of that comes with a user's manual. And I believe this text, this ancient Sanskrit text, is a user's manual for the human mind of thousands of years ago, and the human mind today has not changed in its nature and structure. So the suggestions of Master Patanjali are still alive and strong and can be put to use right now in the modern world of 2022. So the first verse is Atta Yoga Nushasanam. Second one is Yoga Chitta Vritti Nirodaha. Third one is Tada Drastu Swarupe Vastanam. And the fourth one is Vritti Sarupyam Itaratra. Okay, and I will chant them and then I will explain them word by word and how those translations have flowered in my mind. Om Atta Yoga Nushasanam. Atta Yoga Nushasanam. Yoga Chitta Vritti Nirodaha. Yoga Chitta Vritti Nirodaha. Tada Drastu Swarupe Vastanam. Tada Drastu Swarupe Vastanam. Vritti Sarupyam Itaratra. Vritti Sarupyam Itaratra. Atta Yoga Nushasanam. Atta Yoga Nushasanam. Yoga Chitta Vritti Nirodaha. Yoga Chitta Vritti Nirodaha. Tada Drastu Swarupe Vastanam. Tada Drastu Swarupe Vastanam. Vritti Sarupyam Itaratra. Vritti Sarupyam Itaratra. So my wow, I'm you know, that may have been mainly accurate, but I want to share that my vibration, even from a few moments of chanting the Sanskrit, my vibration has shifted. I access some deep memory of the beginning of my journey to the longer arc, and that this practice is still mysterious, and that mystery is important in the pursuit of a lifelong art, that the mystery is what keeps drawing me back to yoga. Even though I think I know what's going on in the process of yoga, each decade of my life, there's a moment or a few years where I feel like a beginner again, like I'm back to square one, with quite a vocabulary, a lot of stories, a lot of interactions with other amazing yogis. But I always sometimes go back to this idea of I'm learning to walk. I'm a beginner. And I don't know if the day I live to 80, 90, or I reach 108, I think that sense of mystery or that idea that I'm a beginner will be alive. That's my guess. It's not something that we master easily. I've been told that it takes up to 12 years to make a new mind, to transform one's consciousness into the consciousness of a yogi. So I've been practicing long enough, but I still from time to time feel like very much a beginner. So let's unpackage this first sutra. Atta Yoga Nushasanam. Atta Yoga Anushasanam. Atta means now. Yoga is the process of union, joining, or yoking. It's basically identifying with our true form, and the individual must attain a special type of concentration in order to feel union with their true form. I've heard some people explain yoga as a separation, that Master Patanjali's cosmology is that yoga is the separation of Purusha and Prakriti. So the soul is Purusha and Prakriti is nature. So the body is nature and the conscious perceiving principle is Purusha, the soul. And the soul is in a body. And once you separate the body from pure awareness through concentration, that is yoga. For now, we will think of yoga as, for the purpose of my explanation, as identity with the true self. So atta is the word now. It's interesting that the text begins with the word now. If you have a moment here to reflect and pause and take a breath, you will realize that your enlightenment is not happening in the future. It hasn't happened in the past. We've had spurts of enlightenment. Enlightenment always is tapping into now, the present moment. So the fact that the text begins with the word atta, now the teachings of yoga begin. So anushasanam means teaching or exposition. So we can translate this as now the teachings of yoga begin. And there are other Sanskrit texts, many that where the word atta opens up the text. It seems like the appropriate word now. We are all going to become enlightened now, not in the past, not in the future. There's so much richness and freedom in the word now and in the present moment, which is happening now. There's an eternal now always happening. And, you know, I have friends who rock climb. They climb difficult mountains. And they, one of the reasons they're attracted to it is because they're super focused on their next move of what do I do now to get out of this tricky spot on the mountain. So by being in pure awareness of the moment to moment existence, like I've felt this actually in my last marathon that I ran. I've run three. So when I ran the Brooklyn Marathon, I hit the wall hard and my brain and body were competing for fuel. And obviously the brain's going to win. So my body, my muscles and the body started to shut down. And all I could think about was like, how can I take my next step? How will I finish the next mile? And life became very reductive and very simple. There was so much physical pain, but so much reduction of the noise in my mind from the next step, the next 800 meters, the next mile, and the mile after. How will I proceed from moment to moment? That was a gift, despite all of the physical pain I was in. I was experiencing psychological freedom from the worries of life, from the worries of the stress that the whole planet is going on that we can all be immersed in. I was becoming free of that because I was tapping into the present moment. So it's appropriate that Patanjali begins with the word now. And he's saying now the exposition or the teachings of yoga begin. Yoga Sutra 1.2. The second sutra is Yogash Chitta Vritti Nirodaha. The word yoga, again, is we're going to, for the purpose of this exposition here, we'll call it union or the process of yoking. Chitta is consciousness or the field of thought or the field of consciousness. Imagine a field, a big field, and we can plant seeds in there. Each thought is a seed in the field of consciousness. This is the way I look at it. Chitta is a field of thought, okay, or consciousness. So in our range of things to perceive, the full range is perhaps the field of chitta. Now, vritti we can think of as the turnings or the movements of consciousness. Nirodaha means stilling, or the cessation of, or the restriction of the movements of consciousness. So basically, a vritti is like the memory of a mango chutney that my mom used to make for me as a treat with roti, that just the memory of it stimulates the desire for my favorite meal. And my mom, when I'm about to go home for a holiday, she knows how much I like this meal. So she will in advance get the best mangoes that are ripened appropriately to make this food in a way to stimulate and make her oldest son happy. So she knows it's my favorite meal. The vritti is the turnings, just the memory or the smell of the spices in the chutney makes me happy and makes me desire the food. So nirodha is to stop the mind from cessation of thoughts. Okay, so it's to stop thinking. So here is the literal, if we string this together and unpack this aphorism, yogash chitta vritti nirodha, we'd say yoga is the stilling of the patterns of consciousness, or yoga is the cessation of the fluctuations of mind. Or in plain English, when the mind is empty, there is yoga. When the mind has no thoughts, there is yoga. So this is union. Union or identity with our true self is when the mind is empty. So this is the classic definition of yoga. Yogash chitta vritti nirodha is yoga is the stilling of the patterns of consciousness. So the mind has no movement. The next one, third one, tada drastu swarupe avastanam becomes tada drastu swarupe vastanam. Okay, that A sort of merges away with the chanting. So tada means then, drastu is the witness or the seer or pure awareness, the eternal witness inside. Swarupe is identity or essence, own essence. Avastanam is the state of abiding. So we can translate or unpackage this third aphorism of Master Patanjali as then pure awareness can abide in its true nature. So when the mind is stilled, as expounded upon by the previous sutra, then the pure awareness can abide in its very nature. The fourth sutra, vritti sarupyam itaratra, word for word, vritti is the turning or movements of mind or patterning of the mind. Sarupyam is identification or conformity. Itaratra means otherwise. So to unpackage this one, and then I'll read all four in plain English so that there's some cohesive thread to unpacking the Sanskrit, means the fourth sutra means otherwise, awareness takes itself to be the patterns of consciousness. What this means is we identify with our thoughts. And this is where most people on June 7th of 2022, all of us are identifying with the patterns of consciousness or our thoughts. We take our thoughts to be the most real thing, and they rile up our emotions, and we repeat the same patterns of behavior over and over. We are waking up the same and going to sleep the same almost every single day. So let's iterate all four sutras from book one, the first four, in plain English. Sutra one, now the teachings of yoga begin. Sutra two, yoga is the stilling of the patterns of consciousness. Then pure awareness can abide in its very nature. That's number three. And number four, otherwise, awareness takes itself to be the patterns of consciousness. I'm going to iterate all four again. Now the teachings of yoga begin. Yoga is the stilling of the patterns of consciousness. Once this has happened, then pure awareness can abide in its very nature. And if we don't do that, otherwise, awareness takes itself to be the patterns of mind or consciousness. And again, I suggested because of perhaps the threat of Buddhism rising and taking over Indic thought, some scholars believe this is why Patanjali has codified the sutras, and they spring up at the same time when Buddhism is gaining popularity throughout India. And the Buddha was a guy who rejected the Vedas to teach the middle way. He was less about rituals and more about personal responsibility. And again, that focus on practice, that's what's really attractive to me, that direct experience based on practice, getting away from the Brahmin priest and the ritualization of, you know, paying for favors, paying for blessings, top-down spirituality, bottoms up is the way to go. Patanjali gives a system that can be preserved. It comes at a time when memories are declining and this era of darkness we call Kali Yuga is coming stronger and stronger. So knowledge systems needed to be fossilized and preserved. And one of the useful ways of thinking of the Yoga Sutras for me is, here's a handful of ways I look at them. They can be seen as a user's manual for our mind. It can be looked at as a book that helps us get the most out of our life. It can be looked at as the wisdom teaching from our ancestors. So I have a fascination with ancient civilizations, like the Vedic culture of the Himalayas and the Mesopotamian Valley, the Indus River Valley civilizations. What were they up to? What were their art teaching us about how advanced they may have been? And are we experiencing a decline in knowledge instead of a true attainment of wisdom? As we get more technologically advanced, we seem to be breaking our bonds with nature. This seems to be the cost of advancing technologically. We are in a super futuristic world with a Neolithic caveman type of mind in many ways. Another way of thinking of the sutras is it's a form of eternal knowledge. So that's attractive to me. Like, how is a teaching from thousands of years ago still relevant today? Fascinating to me, endlessly fascinating. We can also look at it as a path towards enlightenment. Okay, so there is suffering. If I observe my experience, I see that sometimes I compare myself to others and I wonder, why are they more successful than me? What have they done? And this causes a mental affliction and suffering. And when I study texts like the sutras, I become content. I become respectful of my own karmic path, and I take responsibility for where I am headed based on what I am doing now. So who I will become is based on current action. And so this is enlightening. It's enlightening to realize that I'm not racing against someone else. I am really working with myself and on a personal journey. I look at the sutras also as a tool for aligning body, mind, and spirit. Okay, physical body, field of thought and mind is less local, and spirit is all over the darn place. Spirit is one. So it's a tool for aligning the seen with the unseen and resolving the whole meta pattern or lattice work that we are all a part of. It's also a technique for purifying speech. When I say Atta Yoga Nushasanam, my mind is with the enunciation and the vibration of the palate, upper palate. It's hitting all the parts of my brain, the sound, my central column, my chest is vibrating. So it purifies speech. I think less and less about cursing, or I want to refine my use of vulgarity. There's still occasional F word from being an athlete, an occasional jocular manner about, people's sexuality from time to time, these juvenile ideas from playing sports my whole life and being around a pro sports locker room. There's still trash in my mind. And this is a technique for purifying that speech, because a lot of kids and young men listen to what I put out and my talks. So I think about that. I think about keeping the swear words that are positive and empowering and that lead to positive action, and minimizing and trimming away of the unessentials and the things that are more lowbrow in my speech. So sutra helps because it's essence. Patanjali is sharing the essence of a deep teaching, and they are tightly packed. So it purifies speech. The word yoga, okay? Yoga can be chanted, and we can feel yoga through chanting the sutras, and then experience yoga later on when we are kind to someone, when we had the option to be mean or to gloss over someone. We pay them a little more attention because the sutra, we're hearing it in our consciousness mentally from having chanted it. So it's definitely a technique for purifying speech. I also look at it as, hey, just for intellectual purposes, this is one of the greatest philosophical texts of all time, considering all the religious traditions. Some people read the Bible, some people read the Quran. This text is worthy of a lifetime of study. And again, it's the bullseye. You can study it on the periphery, the outer rung of the bullseye. And each time you look at it and read it and read a new transliteration of it, you get closer and closer to the center, and perhaps never really hitting the bullseye, which keeps it mysterious, but getting more and more out of it with time over the years. I look at it also as the real yoga. I know this is going to be a little controversial because all yoga is real yoga. Asana, for me, is one of the eight limbs. Like, imagine the eight limbs of yoga as a flower with eight petals, and there's eight practices on the flower. And so all the limbs can be practiced simultaneously. And in the West, we practice mainly asana. And I have put great value on asana, and 20 years of my life have been devoted to asana. But the real yoga is, thinking about now my ethics, when no one is looking at me, when no one is, the light is not on me, how do I behave in the privacy of my own home, in my relationship with my partner, in my relationship with those who help me in my business? How do I treat people around me? This is the real yoga, where you go into the darkness in your own mind, into the shadows. And once you turn your flashlight on in the shadow, it pushes you further into the light. You understand human nature a little more through wisdom texts that are left behind by folks who concentrated their mind. And I, again, believe Patanjali has experienced yoga. He is a yoga master. So he's teaching and writing from his experience. I've said it before, I'll say it again. It's also a manual of how to still your mind. Our mind is filled with trash. I remember 2021, most of my life, I've had a distrustful relationship with the government and politicians and big pharmaceutical companies. Pharmaceutical companies have the greatest fines for violating regulations and safety protocols. Politicians are constantly lying, looking for the next useful idiot to sell an idea to. And the government has been slowly, over 25 years, been shredding the Constitution and reducing the rights of the American people and their privacy. So I don't pay attention to politics most of the time. I get secondhand news, and this helps me to concentrate on these wisdom teachings from our ancestors. But in 2021, you know, our country was locked down, even though there was evidence to suggest that it did not need to be locked down for as long as it had been, and that it was not needed. It was not producing the results they hoped it would produce. The point is, I could not leave my house. I noticed that people were policing speech, like there are things you weren't allowed to say or question, and that you had to listen. There was a totalitarian energy of mandates, like you have to do this in order to work and travel. Now, I'm super pro-vaccine, I'm pro-choice, but I was against these dangerous ways of thinking, and I got sucked into the political cycle, the drama, because I was being strangled and politics came to my door. And so my consciousness was involved and sucked into it. And it brought my energy into a negative, negative space. So a path to the peace that passes all understanding, which is yoga, was eluding me. It was eluding me. And I was sucked into the surface level of the culture wars that most of us were drawn into. Parents and children, father and son, brother and sister, felt differently about some of these things like vaccines and mandates. And so it started to split us apart as a culture. And I became a part of that dissonance, that disharmony. And I can see the difference in, again, regaining my composure and staying away from the news cycle firsthand and getting secondhand news is very beneficial for me. And learning to pick my battles is a useful way of thinking. I pay attention to things that I'm interested in. Like, I let parents solve the issue of how children should be educated in schools. Even though I have opinions about that, I don't think it's primary to share those opinions, put them out first, because it's to have a handle on every social issue is very difficult. I'd rather focus on the path towards enlightenment and create spaces like my yoga classes and retreats where people can cohere. Varied peoples from different backgrounds can move and breathe together and feel a connection to each other. And this way of thinking has led me, as 2022 is a more social year without lockdowns and we're re-engaging one another, I don't ask someone's politics. That's like last on my mind, or third or fourth. I try to get to know a person's hobbies and their skills and what brings them to life, what they're passionate about. And once I've had a connection with them, if their sense of politics rises and it's different, I could overlook it. I can see it as, oh, this person has had a unique news feed to their biases, and I've had a unique news feed to my biases. So we have different streams of information and we're making sense of the world in a different way, but it doesn't mean that they're any less of a person or that they are unworthy of being treated well because they have a different point of view. So I've gone back to creating spaces for coherence and coming together and realizing that my highest goal in this lifetime is to help people align body, mind, and spirit. So by the lockdowns going away, by the vaccine mandates being lifted, I could breathe again and focus on the application of the sutras. I got sucked out of my concentration by the pressures placed on society. So these first four sutras are anchored in my mind, and I learned to chant them from my friend, a Brahmin named Surya in New York City. Surya wanted to learn asanas, and I wanted to learn the sutras. So he helped me to chant many of the verses, and these first four I can chant them on any day of the week or before a yoga practice. It only takes a few moments, and it sets me into what we call the bhav or bhavanam, which is, it makes a sort of a divine mood or a divine energy to my practice of vinyasa yoga, where I link the movement and breath and I have a relaxing closing sequence. I'm in a good vibe by thinking of, now yoga begins. Yoga is the stilling of the mind. Once the mind is still, then pure awareness can abide in its nature. We can feel our true nature. And if that doesn't happen, I'm going to identify with the patterns of my consciousness or my thoughts. So it's a constant, what I would call an anchor, or what a Westerner would call their overarching intention. So intention, movement, and breath can become one in a modern day yoga practice. And these first four sutras help me to go very deeply into the intention of what I am doing with myself in yoga. So as I tie this together, I'm going to quickly do a cursory view of the eight limbs of yoga, which you will not find in the first chapter. You'll find these in chapter two, called Sadhanapada. Sadhana is the chapter on practice. Okay, so what do we do with our life? And I want to share that the eight limbs of yoga can be practiced simultaneously. And this, again, is a cursory look at it. If you want to read the sutra and study it, and I recommend, it's not like a novel or a sci-fi story that can make sense the first time. You have to study the sutras many, many, many versions and over. And a good starting point is a book, an interpretation by Swami Satchidananda, who opened the opening speech at the first Woodstock Festival in 1969, I believe. That was near my house where I grew up, five minutes from my house in Bethel Woods, New York. His commentary is a good first look. And then another one you want to get is by Edwin Bryant, Dr. Edwin Bryant. And then from there are endless commentaries. I have so many that I can, look at from different point of views and interpretations. Some people have resequenced them to make more sense to the modern world. But book two describes the eight limbs of yoga. And we'll look at them real quick in English. So number one is good ethics, which is to treat others well. The Sanskritists will call this yama. Another one is self-discipline, which we call niyama. And these are observances. Okay, so ethics and observances, codes of conduct. How does a yogi behave with respect to others and themselves? Asana is the third limb, and we can think of that as a comfortable seat or a stable posture. So all of the asanas we do lead back to being able to sit with ourselves comfortably in our own skin. Okay, so can you come to meditation, soften your gaze or close your eyes and be with your breath and be at peace? Everything leads back to a comfortable seat or a stable posture. Pranayama is breath control, and there are infinite varieties of breath control. The primary breath control that I teach is Ujjayi Pranayama, which is an even breath, an even inhale to four counts is what I use. An even exhale to four counts is what I use. So inhale to four, exhale to four. Now, it doesn't have to be four. It can be five or six, but it's even. And this makes the mind equanimous, and the mind starts to settle, and you become very detached from the process of thinking. And this wonderful sense of detachment helps us to see things as they are. The next stage would be sense withdrawal. Sanskritists would call this pratyahara, or drawing in. For example, this is emphasized by the practice of, when you do yoga, You have a drishti or a looking place. Sometimes you look at your fingertips. Sometimes you look at your navel. Sometimes you look at the tip of your nose. So there's always a place to focus sight so that we don't leak so much of our energy. We leak a lot of energy when we look around all over the place because the brain, consciously or subconsciously, is naming and categorizing, and it's making sense of more objects. And this takes energy. So sense withdrawal is pulling that energy internally and consolidating it inside of ourselves so we have concentration. So when we breathe, we also make a sound. The sound of the breath is coming from the area around the entrance of the nostrils and the constriction of the glottis in the throat. So by the sound of the breath, we are focusing another sense, which is the sense of hearing. We can use the sound to tune into rhythm. And so by focusing on sight and sound and pulling that internally, we are harnessing tons of energy. So sense withdrawal or pratyahara is another limb of yoga. The next limb is concentration. We call this dharana, or slowing down the movements of the mind. Okay, so we hone a concentration. We want to concentrate deeply. The step after that is uninterrupted concentration or meditation. This is dhyana. This is where you can think of concentration as take a container of oil and pour it into a cup. Okay, when you're pouring the oil and it's in drops from the object, from the container into the cup, the shorter the space in between the drops, the deeper the concentration. The minute it moves into one stream from the container into the cup, that's an uninterrupted stream. That uninterrupted flow is meditation or dhyana. And the final state or limb of yoga is samadhi, which is an absolute bliss that comes from a non-dual state of perception. So this is feeling the bliss of our own self. It's feeling full contentment. It's feeling the fountainhead from where all meaning comes from. It is the one supreme consciousness. And it's a gift of, again, uninterrupted meditation. So treat others well, express self-discipline, develop a comfortable, stable seat or posture, learn breath control, understand how to withdraw your senses, attain deep concentration, slow the moving mind, and uninterrupted meditation and pure awareness. These are the eight limbs of yoga. Very quickly, again, very cursory approach to the five yamas. Okay, the five yamas are nonviolence, truthfulness, non-stealing, continence, and greedlessness. Aparigraha is greedlessness. Brahmacharya is sexual responsibility with the sexual energy. Ashteya is non-stealing. Satya is truthfulness. Ahimsa is non-violence. These are ways of being for a yogi in the world. The five niyamas are cleanliness, contentment, spiritual austerity through heat building practices, study of the sacred scripture or study of one's thoughts, oneself, self-observation. And this is optional, but is recommended, surrender to a higher power or surrender to God. And these 10 things make the way of the yogi or the way of behaving. The yogi wants to be nonviolent. The yogi wants to tell the truth as much as possible. These things lead to peace. So nonviolence, truthfulness, non-stealing, sexual responsibility of that energy that we want to be so outward normally, being responsible with it, not spreading it around too recklessly. greedlessness, okay, taking what you need and not stepping on other people's backs to get what you want. This will create more peace. Cleanliness, contentment, have discipline or heat in your practice. Study of texts like the Bhagavad Gita or the Yoga Sutra, or study of your thoughts, responsibility for your thoughts, and surrender to God. Okay, so, or praying to a higher power. These things help us to attain yoga. So the first four sutras are a doorway. They explain what the goal is of yoga. They give a very clear map or definition of yoga. And the yamas and niyamas are how to behave, how to act in order to realize the goal of yoga. And it takes a long time. So humility has been key on the longer arcing journey. As I've matured spiritually, I almost feel like I would say 5 years into the journey, I would pretend to know more than I know now. And now I feel like often like a beginner, like my path is constantly just beginning, and I'm way deep into the practice. So a sense of humility and non-judgment for others who have this true nature, the bliss that I've felt from yoga is underneath everybody else. It can be obscured by pain, by illusion, by addiction, by mean-spiritedness, but their nature of all beings is the soul. And we share that universal or cosmic soul. And so for me, being able to focus on my own relationship to the yamas and niyamas, like learning, for example, how to be responsible with my sexual energy, has helped me with my business. It's helped me with my relationships. It's created more honesty. It's trimmed away confusion. It's trimmed away selfishness. It's trimmed away awkwardness. And it creates a sense of trust once you learn that brahmacharya suggestion. It creates stability in your eyes, in your spine. It creates the energy of like a good father or a good grandfather, a caring male energy that understands all potentials and possibilities, but chooses goodness and responsible channels for that vibration. So the yamas and niyamas are the motion through which we attain or experience the definition of yoga. So yoga is first and foremost a practice, and it's also a goal. It's also a state. It's a state of consciousness. It's a connection to our true nature, but we need to act through our lifetime. So the yamas and niyamas and the eight limbs are ways of practicing yoga on a full spectrum all the time. So yoga is a very challenging process. You will confront your bad habits. You will confront your demons. You will confront energies from past lives, perhaps. And it's an endless, beautiful mystery to which we can surrender the idea of mastering it. It's ever evolving in our consciousness and our experience, and it's always flowering into new stages of life. As I turn 50 in 3 years, I'm sure I will be practicing yoga in a slightly different way and turn on more of an interest in other limbs beyond just the physical hatha yoga asana oriented aspect. So I hope that my exposition on the first four sutras, the definition, was of some use to you today. I hope that the explanation of the behaviors or actions a yogi can take yama and niyama can be helpful. And I hope that looking at it through an eight-limbed, eight-armed path, that's, yes, samadhi is the goal, but that we experience little bouts of samadhi. When we make love and we peak in orgasm, our mind goes blank. When we are mountain climbing and we get in a tricky area, the mind gets concentrated. When we are running the end of a marathon and we are out of physical energy, spiritual energy carries us. We get higher vibrational forces. We reach to a part of ourself where we find the soul, and it carries us to the finish line. So we are arguably in and out of peak states constantly. It's just that they're short. And yoga is a way to not get obsessed with the goal, but to reform ourselves or refine ourselves in the fire and flames of our effort. So I'm a guy who believes that through personal effort or sadhana, conscious spiritual practice, we can improve our mind, purify the mind, and attain more peace. And that peace can lead to more coherence among all the different peoples and points of view on the planet. I know sometimes it's idealistic to think of world peace, or it's so far out or so crazy. You know, but I'm an extreme person. I've done marathons. I've been on extreme trips to the jungle, to the Himalayas. I've ridden motorcycles in tricky areas. Just because something is difficult is no reason at all to not pursue it. So the little bit of peace I can create in my yoga classes and courses and things like this podcast, if more and more folks start to scale in that direction and the incentives for human behavior start to evolve, like if we started to look at things through the lens of the yogic point of view, which is by taking care of others, we're actually taking care of ourselves, because we all share the universal soul. We're all part of the same cosmic soul with different ego identities. If we could start to think like that, then perhaps human nature can evolve itself from just a plain savagery and selfishness to where cooperation can trump competition. So that is one of the things that inspires me. I came to yoga to find peace with the idea of where do souls go when there's no longer the body. And yoga has helped me find peace about the death of my brother and my own coming death. It's made me more peaceful about that. And so to share it in a way that I understand it up to this point is an honor. And I want to thank you for tuning into my perspective. And again, it's going to be imperfect. It's not going to be spot on. I am a light scholar. I enjoy reading. I love refining my ideas in the light of conversation and new evidence and new insights. But, you know, my exposition on the philosophy of yoga today shares my 21 years of experience with the practice. And I thank you so much for tuning into today's show. Please share it with anyone who would like an enlightening philosophical discussion through the lens of a yogi's experience. And I want to remind you that the show is sponsored by Common CBD. Please use the link in the show notes to order your CBD from Commons. Please reach out to me for personal coaching on your health, your wellness, your mindset. If you're looking to create a change, I'm your guy. If you're looking to firm up your relationship to discipline, I'm your guy. You can go to jaisugrim.com to fill out the form for coaching, and someone will get back to you. And you can also be a contributor to the show to receive unique offerings and be in the council, the inner council, the tribe that is more proximal to my teachings, at patreon.com/JaiSugrim. So thank you everyone for tuning in to this little pod on yoga philosophy. I bid you an amazing, amazing, spectacular day. May the light of consciousness guide you in this very, very interesting time, transformational time that we are all a part of. Okay, have a great day. Thank you.